Support for the Exchange Podcast from NHPR comes from you, our listeners,
and from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Governor Chris Sununu defends payments made by his inaugural committee to family members and close associates. Democrats in the New Hampshire House reignite debate over firearms in the House chamber. And 2018 was a year of massive lottery winners, large all-cash transactions at state liquor stores, fights over Northern Pass, and yes, midterm elections. So we will take a look back at the year that was, and you can be part of this conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. And we're also broadcasting a live video of this radio show, and you can watch that at our Facebook page. Again, search for NHPR Exchange. And joining me today are Dean Spiliotis, civics scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, Union Leader Executive Editor Trent Spinner, and NHPR Digital Producer Dan Tuohy. Thank you very much, everybody, for being here.
Good morning.
Hey, Peter.
Thanks. Again, listeners, the phone number for you to call to talk about both the week's news in the first part of the program and the year in review for the second and third part of the program, number 1-800-892-6477. So starting with the news of the week, let's talk about Governor Sununu's inaugural committee. The union leader did some fantastic reporting on this week. After his first election in 2016, Sununu's inaugural committee raised $450,000, much of it from corporations and lobbyists. It also paid out about $165,000 to people with close ties to the governor, including members of his family and administration. The governor says in doing this, his committee followed the law. Trent, what was the money spent on?
So the money was spent, and thank you, Union Leader reporter Todd Feathers deserves a lot of credit for really digging through a lot of documents to determine where that $450,000 went. And I should note there's also $40,000 still left in that inaugural fund. So some of that money went to the governor. And we're not entirely clear what that money was spent on, but about $40,000 has gone to the governor in the last 2 years.
Gone directly to the governor?
Yes.
Because he says he hasn't profited off this.
He hasn't profited, but reports filed with the Secretary of State's office state that he received reimbursement for, quote, expenses or travel. And we don't know exactly what that was. He said all of that was related to the governor's office and his duties. His father, the former governor and former White House chief of staff, received about $1,000 for van rental and gas reimbursement. His wife, Valerie, another $1,000 for Easter egg hunt expenses. I'm assuming that's part of the governor's official Easter egg role. And then his sister, Catherine, received about $50,000 for expenses, supplies and decor, and consulting. She helped plan these three nights of inaugurals in Nashua and Bretton Woods and in Manchester. There's been a number of expenses totaling about $160,000 going back to his family or people connected with him.
Mm-hmm. So let's hear directly from the governor about what he had to say about this, because he was on The Exchange yesterday. Listeners, if you're curious about the whole conversation, you can find it at nhpr.org. But Laura Kanoy did question him about this, and so did some callers or listeners. Here's how the governor explains how the inaugural committee's decision-making works.
We follow the letter to the law to a T. There's absolutely no question about that. So when you look at how the money is spent, again, we don't have a credit card for the fund, right? So someone will, for example, in my case, I'll spend money. It could be on travel, you know, buying an airplane ticket or gifts for dignitaries. Like sometimes the dignitary will come in. The Easter egg hunt, right? The holiday tea for legislators and state employees to come in. Coffee in the mornings. It could be a variety of different things. We spend the money. We get reimbursed. No one, I don't make any income off of this organization at all. And governors have used the money in this way for decades.
the inaugural money.
It's just never been disclosed, right? I get a little miffed because no one's asking these questions of the previous governor or the previous governor or the previous governor. We just disclose more, and we're more transparent than anybody, so it allows for the questions to be asked. But we follow the letter of the law to a T, without a doubt. If the legislature wants to change the law and require more disclosure, that's fine. We'll follow the letter of the law however they want to do it.
So that's Governor Sununu speaking yesterday on The Exchange. And he also was asked how involved he was in making decisions to pick vendors, providers linked to his family and friends. And here's how he answered that.
Well, a bit. So, you know, when we first got elected, you have about 2 months to raise money and put on the inaugural, right? The inaugural is three different events. My sister really took on that role, did an incredible job. A couple different people in our organization took on that role immediately, did an incredible job raising the money, putting on the events, doing it, you know, exactly as we wanted to do it. And they got paid exactly, in fact, probably even a little below market value, but we'll just say, you know, market value for exactly the services that they provided. They did a great job, right? We hired someone to do that. It's an immense, it's not a couple volunteer hours a week. It's an immense undertaking. It's 80 hours a week, and we paid folks to do that. Other governors, I'm sure, have done the same. They just never had to disclose hiring people or how they did it. So we've been more transparent than anyone ever before. People want to make a political story out of this stuff. You know, let it happen. It doesn't really bother us. If the legislature wants more disclosure, by all means, we'll do whatever they want to do.
The governor there mentioning the importance of fair market rates, saying he thinks he may have paid his sister's company below market rate. And that's important, right, Trent? Because the law says you got to pay fair market rate for these things.
The law says you need to pay fair market rate for these things. And we don't know how much it costs to plan three very large parties for hundreds of people in three different locations. $50,000, you know, that's a question that, you know, that other the people who can answer that. But one of the things that the governor said he was upset that no one's asked other administrations. We've certainly asked. Here's what happened is that the law was changed this year to change the disclosure. So he's the first governor who has to actually disclose his expenses. We've asked previous administrations to do that, and we were able to see some of the money that was raised. So for example, Maggie Hassan raised money from Centene Management, which manages the Medicaid program in New Hampshire. They also donated to Sununu. Sununu received about $25,000 from Eversource. Hassan also received that. The difference is this cycle, it was the first time we were actually able to see expenditures.
Mm-hmm. Dean, did you want to say something?
Yeah, absolutely. And you heard in the clip from Governor Sununu that the standard he is very clearly using is legality. As Trent mentioned, this is a new reporting requirement. We don't really know what previous governors have done. So, you know, the issue is, you know, at least an appearance of a conflict of interest. And if you put aside the question of whether or not it costs $50,000 to plan an inaugural as he paid his sister for consulting services, that may be a reasonable amount. It may be below market rate. I don't know. But the idea that there wasn't someone else other than his sister in the state who could have planned this for him, I find a little bit surprising. So, again, it's the issue of what standard are you using to make these kinds of decisions. I mean, I listened to the interview yesterday. He gave no ground on it, didn't explain why he thought his sister was the best choice for $50,000. And there are other family expenses as well. And I think another thing people would find surprising is that this fund is still in use relatively recently. I think the most recent disbursement was mid-September, which I think people would be surprised to know that this isn't just for the 3 days of the inaugural festivities and then you're done. This is something that can be tapped into for plane tickets, hotels, all kinds of expenses. So I don't think anyone is accusing him of illegality. The question is, it just doesn't look very good. And that's the problem. You know, there's also an investigation at the national level of the Trump inaugural committee, and they raised a lot of money, and there are questions about how that was spent as well. And so, you know, so it's all a function of what standard you want to use. And I don't think anyone's accusing him of illegality, although people are obviously looking into whether or not they met the reporting requirements. It's just, it doesn't look particularly good, and he gave no ground on that in that interview yesterday, which I think is unfortunate.
Go ahead, Dan. Sorry.
You know, people don't really know that Kathy Sununu is really the de facto chief of staff for some of the Sununu family. She worked closely with her dad and, of course, with both of her brothers in their campaigns. So that's one of those things where she is a logical choice for the Sununu family to go to either run the show or to make it work.
I wanted to ask, Dean, and maybe you know this, Trent. Yes, the law is new, but have other governors voluntarily disclosed this kind of information?
Nope.
No?
And we've asked.
Okay.
Yeah, this is very interesting information that we've asked before. and other people have not disclosed it.
And just to get real quick to Dan's point, because I think that's a very interesting thing to hear. He could have said that very easily yesterday on the radio show, but he just chose to avoid that aspect of the listener's email, I believe.
And we filed right to know requests for the actual receipts to see what these reimbursements are for, to try to determine what a fair market value is, what some of these travel expenses are, and we have not received a response to our right to know request yet.
Okay. Other stories of note this week, one of them coming out of the Executive Council. Joe Barton received a pardon from the Executive Council this week. He was a political operative who was arrested at a polling place. Trent, give us the details here. What happened that led to that arrest?
So there was a little bit of a scuffle. Joe Barton was a GOP operative who was at this polling place. I believe it was in Newmarket,
that's right.
Where he was supposed to be just watching for any irregularities. He got into a little bit of a scuffle with first somebody who he was kind of challenging, and then an election official, an inspector from the Attorney General's office, responded to the polling place. There was a little bit of, they had a physical a scuffle, and he was let out in handcuffs. He had four separate charges. He was ultimately convicted on a misdemeanor charge of resisting arrest. But here was the rub. If he works as an engineer at the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard, so he would not be able to keep his security clearance and go to his job unless he got a pardon here or an annulment. And so the Executive Council on a 3-2 partisan vote decided to issue him this pardon. Democrats were very upset about it. They said that this was outside of the scope of the Executive Council's authority, or not authority, but out of a procedure that they followed before, and that there is a procedure that he should have followed through the court process. So people were upset.
So the Democrats were saying the court did its job legitimately. There doesn't seem to be any errors in the execution of justice here. So we're just doing this because it's political and because this guy wants it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It would seem that way. And, Joe Barton, of course, the Supreme Court upheld his conviction for resisting arrest. And if the Supreme Court order on that is really telling, it talks a lot about the evidence about the investigator, a career police officer, identify himself at least four times that he was an officer and that this gentleman would be arrested. And it's one of those things that it's quite a story in 2014 where it took four police officers to actually put the handcuffs on Joe Barton.
Wow.
So, but he certainly had a good week this week, Joe Barton.
It just shows you also the impact of the fall midterm election, because this was 3-2 along party lines. In January, you're going to have 3-2 Democratic. So these particular decisions. Also, we had the recent decision to confirm Republican Dan Saint-Hilaire to the Superior Court, I believe. That might not have gone through in the new Executive Council. So this really was kind of the last opportunity for some of this to be done.
Is this typical for the Executive Councilors to consider pardons on the last meetings of their term?
This is definitely not typical. And that was one of the things that Councilor Pappas, who's going to become Congressman Pappas, said. He said it overturns a fair trial, ignores the findings and recommendations of law enforcement, and the Executive Council is supposed to guard against granting arbitrary pardons. And he said that it was setting a dangerous precedent, and especially because of the timing of when the pardon happened, that it just wasn't right.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. And still to come in this hour, we're going to talk about the biggest stories of the year, 2018. Been a long year, it seems, and we have a variety of stories to talk about. But we want to hear from you. If you have a comment on a story that you really want us to talk about as we look back on the year, give us a call now so we can bring you into the conversation. The number is 1-800-892-6477, or send us a quick email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. Also in the news this week, something of a perennial issue, I guess, whenever the House chamber flips the majority party, which is that, Democrats have reignited debate about guns in the House chambers. Should guns be allowed? Democrats say no, because, sometimes kindergartners or young school children want to visit, and teachers are, I guess, a little wary of bringing kids into the House chambers when there's guns allowed.
Yeah, this has been a story of the legislature seesawing back and forth between the Democrats and the Republicans over the past 8 years. Before 2010, this rule that the new House Speaker wants to have put in place was in effect. It swapped in 2011, and it swapped back again. It looks like if the Democrats have the votes in the House, it will happen again, where the members of the House on the House floor will not be able to carry their firearm.
Yeah, this is becoming almost a tradition when party control changes in the chamber that this particular rule is amended. And, you know, this gets to the core debate between Democrats and Republicans about whether or not you're safer when people are concealed or constitutional carrying, depending on your preference for terminology. And as you mentioned, you know, I think fourth graders, I think I recall my daughter doing this, fourth graders have kind of part of their curriculum is they come to the state house and there's some concern about that. A couple of guns have been dropped. There's also a concern that, you know, some folks who, you know, maybe their shooting skills aren't all that great and there's a crisis and people start shooting and there's unintended consequences in the crossfire. So that's just a core debate between Democrats and Republicans. And it basically just kind of goes back and forth whether or not you are more or less safe when more people are carrying.
Yeah. And Casey McDermott had a story on this as well this week. And the takeaway that I had was that Speaker Shirtlift also mentioned that there will be a greater security presence at the State House. And to what degree that is, it'll be remains to be seen. But that's a notable coming into 2019.
One more story from this week that we should talk about. This came from Republican State Representative Jack Flanagan, who said he wants so-called same-age exemptions that currently exist under the state's statutory rape law to be applied to the felony charge of using a computer to lure a minor for sex. This is the law that people may have heard of in the context of the Owen LaBrie case, the St. Paul student. He must register as a sex offender for luring a then 15-year-old student for a sexual encounter. Dan, what about these same age exemptions? What exactly would that mean?
Yeah, I know. I read the story from Ethan DeWitt in the Concord Monitor and the Valley News as well, where it sounds like Jack Flanagan is looking at something that's come up in the House before about this age where, you know, the teenagers are 18 and whatnot, of age of consent, and they're in high school with these 13, 14-year-olds. But this case in Jack Flanagan, again mentioned, his proposed legislation will be modified probably significantly before it's in bill form. But he's looking at, again, Owen LaBrie is the case where he's registered as a sex offender. And just this week, of course, we learned that he'll be serving the remainder of his term, I think 10 months, the day after Christmas.
Mm-hmm. And people who support, I mean, this will be a pretty, my guess is a fairly controversial debate, but people who support the kind of change that Flanagan is suggesting argue that the intent of the original law was to stop adults from engaging in, you know, sort of pedophilia and luring people who are underage into encounters. And so the idea is that, well, if it's a couple of teenagers, that's just kind of how they interact with each other. And this is really at the core of LaBrie's, I think his final appeal really is that his counsel initially way back in 2015 did not focus on this computer charge that now means he has to register as a sex offender for life. And so he's arguing he had inadequate counsel. Now, you know, victims' rights groups and other groups in the same area likely will oppose this and argue that you shouldn't weaken these laws at all.
Listeners, give us a call if you have questions about the news, particularly about the news of the year, because that's what we're going to start talking about after the break. The number is 1-800-892-6477. We will talk about one story to start, and that, if you can remember this from early 2018, the anonymous New Hampshire Powerball lottery winner, the story of how she ended up staying anonymous even after winning $560 million through the lottery. We'll talk about that after a break. We'll be right back.
Every convention about how true crime stories usually unfold is upended.
That's why Bear Brook, the latest podcast from NHPR, has been downloaded more than a million times.
30 years ago this month, a mystery began.
It's the story of a decades-old cold case that's changing how murders will be investigated forever, reported by NHPR's own Jason Moon.
This story is not going to go the way you think it is.
Download it now or check it out at bearbrookpodcast.com.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm here with NHPR's Dan Tuohy, union leader, editor, Trent Spinner, and Dean Spiliotis of SNHU, and with you, Feels like the pace of news picked up this year. We've got a variety of stories to talk about that made our top stories of the year list. We're going to get to that in just a moment. But first, want to mention something about something we were talking about in the previous section of the show. We were talking about Governor Chris Sununu and questions surrounding spending done by his inaugural committee. We discussed a little bit about what previous governors had done, and in reporting from NHPR's Josh Rogers, we were finding that Governor Maggie Hassan's committee chose not to file inaugural committee reports, but her predecessor, John Lynch's committee, had voluntarily said it had used the money for things like entertaining state employees, the Christmas tree lighting at the official governor's residence, and for some travel. So there is some precedent for voluntarily releasing some of this information. That's from NHPR's Josh Rogers. So let's talk about the Powerball winner, one of the big stories of the year in 2018. Earlier this year, we learned that the winner of this $560 million Powerball jackpot lived in New Hampshire, and she wanted to remain anonymous because, you know, winning that amount of money is definitely a life-changing experience, and you can draw a lot of unwanted attention when people suddenly find out that you are super wealthy. So with the advice of her attorney, and Trent, correct me if I'm wrong on these details, she signed the back of the ticket and then later realized, oh no, that's public information. So she wanted to sort of challenge the nature of that public publicly available information, and that's where the problem was, right, Trent?
Right. So the problem was that she didn't talk to her attorney before she signed the back of the ticket.
She signed it, then talked to her.
Exactly.
Attorney.
So there, what happened was, so on the back of the ticket, it says, "If you win, sign this. It's a bearer instrument, which means that anybody who has it can go cash it in for $560 million." So she looked at the back of the ticket. She looked at the lottery website, which both of them said, "Sign this ticket." Here's what happened. Bill Shaheen then puts out a press release saying, if you would like, after the winner had already happened, he puts out a press release. He's the only attorney in the state to do this. And a newspaper rewrites it and runs this, and she reads it in the newspaper saying, if you would like to remain anonymous, don't sign the back of the ticket, call Bill Shaheen. And that's what happened. So Shaheen and his partner, Gordon, they went to court to basically protect her privacy, her name.
Mm-hmm.
And the attorney general's office, so the state, argued that her name needed to be released, which was great for us. That's, you know, we've, the union leader and a number of other media outlets, filed right to know requests for the name. The idea being that we need to know, the public has a right to know that the lottery isn't paying out money to their employees or
right.
to, you know, the lottery commissioner, right? We would like to see the name of the person who won and be able to verify that the government is doing their job and that this isn't, that there's no scandal here. Yeah. So a judge took it up. It was a huge court hearing. It was covered basically by every national media outlet. But the judge ruled that her name can, in fact, be private, that she could cash this into a trust, essentially, and that the only thing that should be released is her hometown of Merrimack.
Okay. So, I guess the reasoning was, is that if you can satisfy the disclosure requirements by showing the name of the trust, then it stands to reason that the person doesn't necessarily have to be disclosed, but the name of the entity.
Right. And the judge, Judge Temple, basically said there was no evidence that there was any wrongdoing on behalf of the New Hampshire lottery.
Mm-hmm.
And so unless somebody could provide some evidence that there was, something that the lottery had done wrong, or that there was some inappropriate or conflict of interest or anything like that, that her name wouldn't necessarily be proof that something wrong had happened.
Yeah, and Peter, as you mentioned in your introduction here, there are a lot of stories out there of individuals and families who have literally almost suffered as a result of the publicity that comes from winning millions and millions of dollars. So I've noticed in recent years there's a really cottage industry in how to deal with these mega jackpots in a way that preserves family privacy. And the issue was what most people do now, or a lot of people do, is they set up some sort of family trust or other kind of entity to deal with the winnings, rather than just sign the back of the ticket in their own name. And I think you're going to increasingly see that in states where that's a possibility.
Dan Tuohy.
Of the top 10 lottery winners in New Hampshire history, about five of them have trusts set up. So it is something, as Dean mentioned, it's popular. It may become more popular with the internet
mega,
age.
And we're getting these mega, you know, billion-dollar jackpots now that are just mind-boggling.
This was also one of the top stories on NHPR.org in 2018. You know, $500 million. It's absolutely amazing, a crushing lottery. You see this coming up. Governor Hassan, when she was governor, vetoed a bill that would allow winners of lotteries to remain anonymous. And just a week ago, the New York governor vetoed a similar bill. So this is coming up in other states as well that have these, as Dean mentioned, these huge lotteries.
My favorite part of this story was we were getting all these calls and emails to the newsroom from people saying, I know that you know her name. Can you just pass along this message? There was this one. I mean, people from overseas were emailing us saying, if I could just have a little bit of money to pay off my mortgage and my medical bills, just $1 million, everything would be okay with my life.
And
we got dozens of those into the newsroom.
From Nigeria?
From I remember from Puerto Rico and from South America and from Europe. And it was just fascinating to see all these people's dreams and how this one story kind of focused all of that right here in New Hampshire.
And I imagine that's just a taste of what the actual winner would go through if they were made public.
Yes. And the law firm, I think, also we did a follow-up story with them. They also received a flood of requests for money. And it sounds like this person may be doling out some money to causes that they care about.
Worth mentioning that I have once tried to contact one of the publicly known winners of a previous lottery, and not surprisingly, I did not get a call back. Probably done with all the attention that winning a lottery has brought about. Wanted to mention something before we move on to the next story, which is that Dan Tuohy has done a massive amount of excellent work at NHPR.org, putting together lists of the top stories for each month at NHPR.org, sort of tracking web hits and whatnot. Also, some beautiful photographs that our reporters have taken over the past year. Check it out at NHPR.org. And Dan, congratulations on just creating a beautiful website.
Well, thank you. I had a great staff to work with here at NHPR.
Yeah. Let's talk about another story that really made waves this year. NHPR's Todd Bookman did some excellent reporting on allegations that the state liquor stores were looking into the way, or rather were looking the other way, when people from out of state came to buy a large amount of liquor from New Hampshire liquor stores using cash. Executive Counselor Andrew Walensky alleged that people were making large cash transactions that came just under the threshold for reporting the transaction on paper. Dan, what did Counselor Walensky see that was so wrong about this?
Well, even now, Councillor Andrew Walensky is convinced that there's bootlegging going on and illegalities going on and perhaps violations of IRS rules and laws. He's saying that, you know, these out-of-state people are coming with large all-cash sales and keeping it below the $10,000 limit that would trigger a reporting. And, you know, he's saying that and he's obviously contacting some, whistleblowers, for lack of a better term, people who work for the state in these liquor stores, saying that some of these people drive a truck up to one store, buy $9,000 worth of booze, Hennessy, and then go to another store and do the same thing.
Yeah. We actually have some tape of Councillor Walensky speaking about this. Here he is.
This is a big enterprise, and the liquor sales fund a lot of important state programs. And so if I'm being told that part of those liquor sales may not be legal, may subject us to suit by a neighboring state, may put our employees in some danger, it becomes my responsibility to raise the issue.
So, Dan, has the state been sued, as Councillor Walensky warned about?
No, but the state attorney general's office has, in the past month, come out and said there's been no wrongdoing on behalf of the New Hampshire Lottery Commission, which is a big thing to note.
Yeah.
This is still going on.
Yeah, still going on. And sort of a surprisingly, well, maybe surprising to me, but not surprising to you, Dean, that this was sort of a partisan issue, too.
In what way?
Well, from what I've heard, that, you know, Democrats like Walensky were really coming out strong against this. Maybe, Trent, you want to weigh in on this, but Republicans seem to be defending the Liquor Commission more than the Democrats were.
Republicans were upset the way Councillor Walensky handled it. Councillor Walensky dressed up in a hat and jeans and worked with a state employee to get into areas of a liquor store that that would not be open to the public. Mm-hmm. And he did not identify himself as an executive counselor when he did that. And so Republicans were upset. In that quote, in that soundbite where he said, it became my responsibility, what Republicans said was, yes, it's the responsibility of state officials to make sure that we're following the laws. It's not the responsibility, as Republicans argued, for an executive counselor to basically disguise himself and go into the stock room at a liquor store to see what's really happening. And so that's where the partisan issue really came in. And then, of course, once Republicans were calling Democrats partisan, Democrats called the investigation partisan. Obviously, the Republican attorney, the attorney general who was appointed by a Republican governor, produced a report that was, I think it was only 2 pages or something. And so Democrats said, well, they're just sweeping this under the rug. And so that's where this all
that's how it
turned
became
partisan.
Okay. Worth noting. Thank you very much for that. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. That's sort of a year in review today. We're talking about some of the big stories of the year. Coming up, we're going to talk about Northern Pass, how it was shot down by the State Site Evaluation Committee, but how that battle still sort of continues. Your thoughts on this still evolving story are welcome. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Or also, you can post on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, which is where we are broadcasting a live video of this radio program today. Before we get to that, though, let's talk about Dartmouth College, because a group of current and former students at Dartmouth College are suing over what they claim is a culture of sexual harassment. They also accused 3 professors in the Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences, Todd Heatherton, William Kelly, and Paul Whelan, of a range of behavior that is considered sexual misconduct. Dan, can you remind us how this story evolved? How did this begin?
Really, over the past year or more. I know Breida Green for NHPR has been reporting on this, and it's in the psychology department, and it's these 3 professors. A couple have retired. Well, I think one is retired voluntarily ahead of time. But the long take, looking back, the president, Phil Hanlon, of Dartmouth College has promised much more of a, I won't say crackdown, but greater guidance. And it's worth noting that he is rebutting the allegations in this lawsuit.
Yeah, I mean, this is a bit of a challenge for Dartmouth because on the one hand, they don't want to be seen as unsupportive of an inclusive student culture. On the other hand, they obviously have to protect the fiduciary interest of the university, I mean, of the college. And, you know, Dartmouth has now unveiled a whole new initiative that's going to kind of try to rebuild the culture on campus, both through curricular and residential changes. And, you know, we've seen cases like this around the country where some very high-profile professors, some of whom control either labs or other sorts of big grant money, and have been sued by graduate students and others for improper behavior. So this has kind of become part of the larger Me Too movement, and you've seen schools around the country struggle with it and starting to make changes. And as you mentioned, these 7 women, I think it is, are suing under Title IX, saying that Dartmouth allowed this culture to be perpetuated.
Yeah, I was going to say, you mentioned Me Too. This is Me Too on steroids. One of the plaintiffs in this case is alleging rape. I mean, it's a very significant charge, as we've all addressed and that the president has as well. And it's part of – you see this at multiple levels, and it's not just private colleges or private schools as well.
It's all over.
Listeners, give us a call if you have questions or comments about some of the biggest stories of the year, 1-800-892-6477. Let's talk about the Wayfair decision. In June, a decision by the U.S. Supreme Court in the case of South Dakota versus Wayfair caused bipartisan consternation among NH officials, including Governor Sununu and the state's congressional delegation. The decision would mean businesses based in New Hampshire, which does not have a sales tax, we all know that very well, they would have to collect sales tax on behalf of other states for their online sales. Here we have Assistant Attorney General of New Hampshire, Anthony Galdieri, predicting that the tax reporting requirements would be overwhelming.
And the last thing we need is for our small businesses to say the risk and uncertainty of doing business over the internet is just too high. I can't afford to do it. And they may very well go out of business if they can't do that.
And the legislature here failed to pass a bill in response to the Wayfair decision during a special session in the summer, but the governor indicated that he wasn't giving up. Trent, what's the governor's position on this?
The state is trying to create an extensive review before any other state can collect taxes in New Hampshire. So let's say you are South Dakota, and residents of South Dakota are buying stuff online from some really cool wool sock company in the North Country. South Dakota can say to that wool sock company in the North Country, you need to collect taxes for South Dakota. You actually need to collect taxes for 45 other states. And I think there are something like 2,000 taxing jurisdictions in the United States. So this could potentially be a bookkeeping burden. So what the Attorney General's office would like to do is basically force any taxing jurisdiction who wants to do this to determine that they meet certain that their legislation in their local jurisdiction meets certain requirements, including an exemption for certain dollar amounts. So let's say you sold less than $100,000 to South Dakota, you wouldn't have to remit taxes to them. There would have to be a prohibition against retroactive enforcement, so you couldn't go back in time to tax people. And there would have to be an exemption for small business. So if you only did a certain amount of sales in a year, you wouldn't have to do this. Mm-hmm. So that's what the that's what the governor was hoping the legislature would pass. It kind of fizzled at the very last minute there. But I would expect that to come back this session.
It has the potential to be a bureaucratic and reporting nightmare, and also potentially a disincentive for small businesses to do online sales, which, as we all know, people increasingly do around the holidays and other times of year. My sense is at this point that the goal in the short term is just to kind of slow this all down and try to figure out a way to either get through it or around it. I don't know how it's going to play out, but I think there certainly has been some pushback, but it feels like we're still kind of in a process of figuring out how to deal with it rather than there doesn't seem to yet to be a solution of how to get around it.
Just to make sure that the other states are, you know, there are 45 states that collect sales tax, and their argument is that there is software available that's cheap or free to allow even small businesses to collect and remit these taxes very easily, and that New Hampshire should just get on board. And so that's their argument, just to make sure that they are represented too.
Okay. One more story to talk about before the break, and that is Northern Pass. This was big news earlier this year. Happened on a Thursday, I remember, and then the roundup on the following Friday turned into basically a show about Northern Pass. The State Site Evaluation Committee denied the permit to Eversource's Northern Pass project, which is a 192-mile transmission line. Faced fierce opposition, especially from folks in the North Country worried about scenery. After that decision, here is former Eversource spokesman Martin Murray responding to it.
We don't go to the state Supreme Court lightly. It's very rare. We only do it when we have conviction and confidence that we'll win the day. And you can probably expect that we will go to the state Supreme Court.
And so they did. They went to the court. And what's their argument? Why are they sort of appealing this?
Their argument is that the site evaluation committee didn't do their job. The site evaluation committee, it even surprised our reporter who had been covering this, covering every session of their. They basically took a vote. And they decided. Our reporter was surprised. I think members of the public who were there watching were surprised that it happened that quickly. And what Eversource is arguing is that they have more evidence that the site evaluation committee did not consider that needs to be considered. So they've asked the Supreme Court to either take a look at that evidence or order the site evaluation committee to take a look at this again. What's interesting is what's happening in the background, which is that Governor Sununu is trying to appoint new people to the Site Evaluation Committee. So they lost the battle at the Site Evaluation Committee. They go to the Supreme Court, which could potentially take another year or two. And in the background, the governor is trying to change the makeup of the Site Evaluation Committee. Potentially to be more friendly to projects like this. So there's a lot of political maneuvering.
Well, we just
happening.
Had the one nominee that was withdrawn, and this was one of the issues that was swirling around that nomination.
Yeah. So you're saying that, you know, it's possible that the Supreme Court could throw it back to the Site Evaluation Committee, which may have friendlier makeup by the time it comes around again?
Is that
what you're saying?
Exactly.
Yep. We got a comment from Merrill on Facebook. She says, I am very concerned about the Northern Pass situation. The SEC made a decision against Northern Pass and Eversource. Now it's up to the Supreme Court to override or agree with the SEC decision. Sununu should have stayed out of this. The people of New Hampshire are overwhelmingly against Northern Pass. Where would it go? Massachusetts does not need or want it anymore. So that's the comment from Merrill on Facebook. My question is, so has Northern Pass made specific allegations about what the SEC did not do when it said it didn't do its job?
Yes. They've alleged or argue that the SEC did not follow citing protocols or procedure. It's basically a rights argument that they're taking to the Supreme Court, a due process rights. And it's a $1.6 billion project, as Trent mentioned, from Pittsburgh to the Deerfield for the substation. It's huge, and if anyone drove north of central New Hampshire over the past 2 years, you'll see those orange signs that say no to Northern Pass. So you know the opposition to it in the North Country to a great degree. Some businesses, of course, do support it. Some unions certainly do support it because of the jobs involved. But it's a big deal. We'll see where this goes. On a separate issue, but the SEC did recently approve the Seacoast Reliability Project, the transmission line on the Seacoast, and part of that goes under Great Bay. So that was also a very controversial project.
Yeah, my recollection on the Northern Pass hearings were that there was some set number of criteria that they were supposed to consider, and they basically shut it down partway through the review rather than going through the entire process.
I always like to take credit. I wrote the very first story about Northern Pass, though we didn't know it was Northern Pass at the time. The mayor of Franklin, Ken Merrifield at the time, who's now a commissioner.
This was when, 2010, 2011?
2010. This was more than 8 years ago now. He kept saying at these city council meetings, I was a city reporter for the Monitor, and he kept saying there's something huge coming to Franklin, something huge that's going to change the landscape. It was a substation for Northern Pass, but nobody knew at the time. And I had one quote from a city councilor saying, I bet it's going to be some sort of electric project or something. And so I'm going into 2019 looking forward to the ninth year of coverage of Northern Pass.
All right. Well, we're going to take a break. During the break, we'll give Trent a badge for being first on the Northern Pass story.
Gold star. Yeah,
gold star. Right on your arm. There you go. And then when we come back, we'll talk more about some of the biggest news stories of the year, including lots of things having to do with voting laws, specifically Senate Bill 3. We'll take a trip down memory lane for that. Tell us how you feel about SB 3 now. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, email exchange@nhpr.org, or post on our Facebook page as Merrill did. Just give a search for NHPR Exchange. You can also watch a live video of this broadcast. We'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello here in the studio with NHPR's Dan Tuohy, union leader, editor Trent Spinner, and Dean Spiliotis of SNHU. We're taking a look back at some of the top stories of 2018, and if you'd like to take a look at some of the top stories at nhpr.org by month, take a look at nhpr.org now. Dan Tuohy's put up a nice post showing which stories were most popular in each month of the year. Let's start this part of the program talking about SB 3. Voting legislation was a topic of much debate in the past year, and SB 3 was one of the most debated parts of that. So, Dean, I'll go to you on this. SB 3 passed in 2017. What were lawmakers trying to do?
Well, it depends on your political viewpoint. Republicans argued that it was a way to tighten up voter registration and make sure that only people who were legally entitled to vote actually voted. It was essentially allowed people who showed up at the polls and signed an affidavit saying that they were eligible to vote. It set a time limit for their needing to provide the appropriate proof of domicile, and if they failed to do that in a certain amount of time, they would pay, I think it was a $5,000 or $6,000 fine. And a while ago now, a judge allowed SB 3 to go into effect. This is prior to 2018, but put a stay on the $5,000 fine. It said the requirements can be in effect, but you can't have that particular fine. And then this time around in 2018, there was a late injunction put on all of SB 3. It then went to the state Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said you can have an injunction, but not until after November 6th election, because it's just going to be too complicated.
The injunction came in mid-October.
Yeah,
right?
It was just too close. The Supreme Court said it was too close to the election. It's fine to have an injunction, but not until after November 6th. So that's where we are right now. And we haven't even mentioned HB 1264,
right,
which is the residency bill that goes into effect next year. So we'll probably be this time next year, I'm sure we'll be talking about 1264.
Having this discussion all over again. Okay. Yeah. So and how might these things be handled? perhaps in a Democratic legislature? Can lawmakers now go back and sort of undo what's been done?
Absolutely. And, you know, the obvious hurdle there would be you have a Republican governor who has supported both pieces of legislation. You know, there had been some controversy that after SB 3, Governor Sununu said that was enough. And then we had that situation where 1264 was sent to the Supreme Court just to get a general sense of its constitutionality before he signed it. You know, once it goes into effect, there will be legal challenges to that as well.
Okay. Dan Toohey.
Yeah, I was just going to say this, the proof of domicile law almost resulted in Bill Gardner losing his job. I mean, it was obviously he was, you know, got a lot of grief for being on the Trump voter fraud commission. You know, some Republicans said it was needed. Others said, and Democrats said it was a sham commission. But SB 3 was very, very controversial in Concord at the State House. Bill Gardner said it was going to be okay. Look, we'll get through it. Democrats in the legislature, the new sheriff in town, don't think so. And this will be coming up in some form. Whether they can get by the executive, we will see.
Since you mentioned Bill Gardner, we should talk about yet another big story in 2018, which is that Bill Gardner almost lost re-election for the first time in 42 years. He was running against Colin Van Ostern, and his sort of voters would be legislators. And Colin Van Ostern lobbied hard for Democrats throughout the state, hoping that maybe some that will turn around and vote for him when it comes time to elect a Secretary of State. Dan, tell us about how that vote went down, because it was kind of a wild day earlier this month.
It certainly was. I mean, Bill Gardner won his 22nd term, right? Narrowly defeated Colin Van Ostern. And, you know, Colin said he had a gracious defeat, saying he brought some of these key issues to the forefront. And hopefully we'll continue doing that, according to him. And we'll see. I mean, it's one of those things where Bill Gardner has been doing this since 76, you know, longer before Trent was born, I think.
Yes.
And it's one of those things. He said, you know, he's going to embrace, you know, some of the modern office necessities, he said in his victory speech. And we will see what that means in terms of transparency, accountability, having better forms for election law on site.
Yeah, and this was a tremendously close vote. It took two ballots. I think the first ballot was 208 to 207, and I think Gardner needed 209 to win, and then they went back out and he got a few more votes, and he was able to win. And it was fascinating to me. I mean, essentially, I think what made the difference was this: Republicans very effectively used a wave of New Hampshire primary nostalgia to say that, you know, here's Bill Gardner, we're coming up on the centennial, the 100th anniversary of the primary. He's been doing this for so long and so effectively that he should get the honor of presiding over that. He himself said he wanted to do that before he retired, and that's the first time we've ever really even heard him mention the possibility of retirement. And so Republicans use this argument very effectively. Democrats were not making any argument about the primary. Their argument was about the voter fraud commission with Trump. It was about the voter registration bills we just talked about. It was about some conflicts between town clerks and Bill Gardner over the scheduling of votes during inclement weather. There was complaints about the technology upgrades to the Secretary of State's website, et cetera. So there were all these other issues, but in the end, it came down to this belief that Gardner deserves to be there for the 100th, for the centennial of the primary. And, you know, my concern, as I expressed here several times, is that Republicans have so tightly tied the future of the primary to the person of Bill Gardner. I started hearing from other stakeholders around the country that, okay, you know, once Gardner's out, it's open season. And I think anybody, whether it's Colin Van Ostern or Deputy Scanlon or whoever the next Secretary of State is, they're going to be just as invested in this because it's in the state constitution. It's a statutory part of the job. It's not just a function of Bill Gardner.
Let's talk about the midterm elections, because this was a story that was impossible to ignore. Many sub-stories, I guess you could say, regarding the midterm elections. And I'll ask each of you this as by way of summary of this, because there were so many candidate stories and issue stories about this. But with respect to this midterm, I'll start with you, Dan. What do you think is the most historically significant thing about this midterm? What will we look back on 10 years from now and say the 2018 midterm was significant because?
That's a tough question. You had to start with me first.
Sorry.
I would say, you know, it's the purple nature of New Hampshire. You know, we're not a Republican state. We're not a Democratic state. We are, you know, somewhere in the middle. You know, obviously the Democrats retain control of the congressional delegation. They flip back the New Hampshire House and the New Hampshire Senate. the Republican administration in the second term of Chris Nunu is there, and it's a divided government. And I think we'll look back at this year as possibly a continuation of divided government in Concord and across the state, or maybe some sort of a sea change.
Just to add to what Dan is saying, I think that what I learned was just how fractured the voting population is, that on both sides, that the parties can't, the traditional power brokers are gone. That, and similar to what's happening in the media, where anyone with an iPhone can have the same voice as the union leader or NHPR, candidates who can raise even $5,000, $10,000 can have the same voice as someone like Chris Pappas. Between social media and the digital age, being able to reach people through email, that candidates, that both parties are so fractured, and that the old umbrella that used to be able to pull people together has gone away, and now anyone with an iPhone or the ability to raise a few thousand dollars can be a player.
Yeah, you know, maybe I was a little bit less surprised than some other folks were. You know, if you look at the modern history of midterm elections, you do see these kinds of swings. We saw it in 2010 after Barack Obama's first 2 years in the presidency. We saw it in 1994 after Bill Clinton's first 2 years. It is not unusual for a president to take a hit in terms of seat loss at his first midterm. And, you know, President Trump's popularity, which I think kind of capped in the sort of low 40s, it was ripe for that kind of a swing. So I think it's part and parcel, as Trent's comments were very interesting, that there's really nobody in the middle anymore, that the parties have become increasingly polarized and disaffected from each other. And it's increasingly all about competitive mobilization and different subgroups within the parties either mobilize or demobilize depending on how angry they are or how motivated they are to turn out. And so I think this is a continuation of a pattern we've seen for 20 years or so now.
Speaking of patterns, one of the patterns we've had here on this program is we talk about animal stories at the end of the show. This was kind of an informal thing, but it seems to stick. So let's talk about a few of the big animal stories of the year. One of them was that Christina Fey was found guilty of animal cruelty after dozens of Great Danes were seized from her Wolfboro home. She was on the hook for almost $2 million in restitution for the care of the animals while the court battle was being waged. Dean, you followed this story pretty closely. Yeah. Where do things stand now?
Well, there may still be one more appeal outstanding. We're trying to figure that out. But this has gone on for a long time. Christina Fey exercised a lot of her right for various appeals. It was a very sad story that hopefully has a happy ending. A lot of them, I think virtually all the 70 some odd Great Danes have been adopted out, I think, at this point. So hopefully they've gone on to have good lives. But, you know, you hear these kinds of stories periodically. And, you know, I expressed throughout our discussion of the story, I expressed some concern that people were referring to her as a breeder, whereas I don't really have any sense that she I've dealt with both, you know, shelters and also breeding operations. I'm a longtime dog owner, did not look anything what I know to be a commercial breeding operation. It seemed more like a hoarding situation. That's just my opinion. And it was very sad. And hopefully it's being resolved. But she's invested a lot of time and certainly a lot of money into trying to get some sort of remediation through the courts. And I think she's allowed to have one dog at a time, I believe, is what the court said. And there have been a couple of – there was a story, similar story to this with a big group of German shepherds, which is near and dear to my heart. I'm a German shepherd owner. And so it's just sad whenever these kinds of – you know, what may have been initially good intentions just kind of get out of hand. And what are kind of characterized in the media as breeding operations really end up being these very kind of sad, almost hoarding type situations.
Yeah, and one of the things to come out of this is that the legislature tried or made an attempt to sort of tighten regulations on dog breeders, regardless of what we can call Christina Fey, breeder, hoarder.
Sure.
Jeb Bradley, a senator from Wolfboro, was really pushing for this, but didn't quite get his way. Lawmakers didn't want to go that far. Apparently, there was also money set aside in this legislation for inspectors for the new regulations, but didn't quite get there.
So. Yeah, that's correct, right? I mean, we may see as these stories continue to pop up, we'll probably see renewed efforts to have more oversight.
Okay, and then another animal story we should discuss, which is that there was an abundance of food And that led to sort of a boom in the population of Dan smiling. He knows what's coming. So this is the story about the squirrels. There were so many squirrels that it kind of led to some gruesome scenes on the highways. Just, you know, lots of squished squirrels on the roads. And, you know, there were a lot of mice as well. Birds had a pretty good year, and they were getting into people's homes. They were looking for food and shelter. I was surprised this got so much attention in the news. Were you, Dan?
Absolutely. And it's the year of the squirrel. I mean, some of these stories that did get so much readership, and not just in New Hampshire, but around New England as well. You know, Breida Green had the first story for us in August, and then the floodgates were open because people realized, as Dean mentioned, or you mentioned, you see these squirrels, the poor carcasses everywhere. It's quite a story. And then, of course, they're trying to get into houses and otherwise wreaking havoc. And or Sam Evans Brown put out in one of his Ask Sam series, I saw a squirrel swimming. This is a sign of the apocalypse. No, hopefully not.
And people were even making these gruesome Halloween costumes about, like, dressing up as Route 95 with like, you know, squirrel dolls pasted to it. It was kind of weird.
There was a really funny post, and I don't know if it was a public post or it was just a doctor, but at someone at Catholic Medical Center dressed up as a dead squirrel. It was a doctor and was on the ER table just laying there. It was probably the funniest costume I've seen this year.
Well, news, I guess, it's not just for informing and enriching your life. It's also for inspiration for Halloween costumes, I guess. So much happened in 2018. We can't possibly talk about it all during this brief hour, but we've got all these stories at nhpr.org. Check it out. We've got a list of which stories were popular each individual month. That's at nhpr.org. But for now, I want to thank our guests for participating in this conversation today. Trent Spinner of the Union Leader, NHPR's Dan Tuohy, and Dean Spiliotis. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for being here this hour.
Thanks,
thank you,
Peter.
And listeners, a conversation about this program will, of course, continue online, and you can follow it at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. And our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and Elaine Loft was answering the phones today. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.